Hello and welcome to a new episode of our podcast, Beyond Core, the podcast for business leaders who dare to think beyond today's success and build a future. As you know, in every episode, we explore entrepreneurial strategies for unlocking new growth beyond your core business, from platforms, digital ecosystems, AI-driven ventures, or circular business models. We dive deep with industry pioneers who are shaping what's next. If you are looking to scale innovation, create new markets, and future-proof your company, you're in the right place. And I'm not doing the podcast by myself. I also have my favorite co-host here with me. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Matthias. Lovely to be here to talk about my favorite topic, as you know.
Yes, exactly. Today it's about trust and safety, your favorite topic. And we have a special guest here. It's Jeremy Gottschalk. He released a new book, Bulletproof Your Marketplace, and he's an expert since years about the whole topic about building trust, safety within your marketplace and platform. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So today you are joining us from Florida, so it's quite of a distance. But we want to shorten the distance and also let our guests know who you are and why is this your favorite topic of trust, risk, building safe environments for marketplaces. Maybe you can give a short intro to our listeners and viewers who you are and yeah, why is this your favorite topic?
Absolutely. So I'm a lawyer by training, sadly, and went practiced IP law initially, which was super exciting, but then got into technology, started working with a lot of startups, eventually went in-house into a childcare and senior care marketplace right after they raised their Series A. I was the first lawyer tasked with, you know, all things liability and exposure and protecting the company. And one of my first questions was, you know, what are we doing to protect these kids? I have a specialty in law when I was in law school called pediatric law. So it was representing abused and neglected children. I originally set out to save the world, but with, you know, too many student loans, I had to go into a law firm just to eat. So long story short, going in-house was a perfect kind of marriage of my training and my interest, but also presented these huge challenges that you know, we find on marketplaces and the internet generally. And so it just became a passion, obviously protecting the company, but also figuring out how do you protect vulnerable populations and people on the internet in general. And very quickly, I realized it's really hard to do. You know, the internet's anonymous and there are bad people everywhere. And if you're not careful, right, you could be the victim of them. So that's really the origin of you know, the book, Marketplace Risk. All of that is really to try and bring leaders in the industry, found everyone from the founders and the C-level, kind of all the way to customer service folks together to talk about kind of the lessons they've learned, the tactics and the strategies they've used in order to create, you know, a better, safer environment for essentially users of the internet. My specific focus is on marketplaces, but there's so much transcends, you know, the internet and e-commerce in general.
Yeah, it's, as you said, it brings also a lot of advantages, but also attracts a lot of bad people and bad behavior. And it's a special topic, especially for marketplaces, to build this trustful environment. And you also mentioned marketplace risk. I know this as a big conference or series of conferences where people can join and can exchange. Maybe you can also a bit of more tell us what you are doing. So you are consulting companies or marketplaces and platforms. So what is your, how do you help them at the moment?
Sure. So Marketplace Risk started as a working group of founders and very senior leaders at a bunch of different marketplaces, from childcare to pet care to the ride share, kind of you name it. We started getting together quarterly just to learn from one another. The group grew organically as more and more people were hearing about this. It wasn't some clandestine or secret meeting, but we just wanted to learn from one another. And So that evolved into a conference 10 years ago now, in 2015, and has grown and grown and grown. And we realized then there are people in Europe who are dealing with the same issues, and then on the East Coast. And so fast forward, we host 5 conferences, San Francisco, New York, Austin, London, and then this year we're also introducing Sao Paulo, Brazil. All focused on trust and safety, risk management, really the stuff that you never learn in business school or that VCs aren't focused on, but are critical to running these platforms. And of course, we also have blogs and podcasts, and we do a lot of virtual content, and we've got a lot of other kind of tactics and strategies to try and network and get the ecosystem collaborating. But our main focus are in-person conferences where people can learn from one another and share and collaborate over all of these topics.
Yeah. Actually, that raises a small question, a small or big, I don't know, question for me. Do you see a difference in the European markets and the American market on that topic?
Yeah, actually. So it's interesting because when you think of, I think the issues are the same, right? The internet is the same no matter where you are. I think one of the big differences is kind of how many platforms are headquartered there or launched there, because you get that kind of mind meld and that knowledge sharing. And one of the things that we found in San Francisco, which is kind of still the epicenter of technology, is you've got all of these companies willing to come together and share. But the reality is, what we found very quickly is traveling to San Francisco, it's difficult. It's really expensive. And if you're working at a startup, the chances of you having resources to fly to San Francisco and stay there, I mean, you lose a vacation quite literally if you end up going to the conference. And so that's why we spread out into different geographies. And there are, particularly, in Europe, right, the EU is very active and has been way more active than any other government on kind of protecting the citizens and really focusing on privacy and a lot of just kind of platform related issues. And then, of course, the U.S. follows slowly, but is starting to look at what's happening in the EU and kind of replicate that. So there are a lot of issues that are different. I think the core is trust and safety issues are the same, but how they're being addressed. One other thing I think that differentiates all the different geographies is the size of the market, I think, will often dictate what solution providers are trying to sell there. And so, for example, in the US, if you look at digital identity providers, or if you look at background screening companies, just because of the size of the market, you'll get a ton. And when you go to other markets, particularly if there's a different language spoken, sometimes they're not addressed at all. Sometimes the solution providers aren't even focused there. And so there's a little bit of a lack of variety, I guess you could say, that we've seen. And we've seen a lot of solution providers, particularly in the fraud prevention and the identity space, starting to expand into Latin America, which is Brazil, of course, huge market, but still it's they're not really being served as much as kind of the US market. And I think the parts of Europe, I think, are much better served now, but in the beginning, it was the solution providers, I think, were very targeted on, particularly if they were US based, right? They were going to English speaking countries, and that was pretty much it. I think they're now really gaining traction, and so that's not it's not the same as it was before. It's improving a lot, but yeah, I think that the problems are basically the same. It's the solutions, I think, that vary, whether it's regulation or solution providers and vendors, things like that.
To make it also a bit more tangible for our listeners, maybe you can, and you have also a chapter inside of your book, looking back and looking at some failures. So maybe you can describe a bit, or you can present some cases where you think those are kind of obvious failures of marketplaces, and this underlines why it is so important to have a look at the whole topic of trust and safety. So why is this important?
Yeah, I mean, if I can go one step backwards, the thing about trust and safety, I think 10 years ago, your everyday user, particularly even if they had an iPhone or a smartphone, didn't really think about trust and safety. It was more coming from the companies themselves. You know, trust is the biggest barrier to conversion, right? So you've got this funnel of potential users who you want to become customers. And in order to convert them, they have to trust. And then, of course, once they trust you and they convert to paying customers, now you've got to keep them safe, right? So there's that component kind of getting them in the door and then keeping them safe. I talk about in the book, there's kind of two phases that when I look at the internet, it's the first 20 years and kind of since then, right? The last 20 or so. In the beginning, there was almost no attention paid by governments, regulators, pretty much anybody. Everyone kind of buried their head in the sand when it came to the internet in general, and I think just kind of pretended nothing bad was happening, right? I mean, you would get, you'd talk or hear jokes about the AOL email scams from princes. As long as you gave them their bank account information, they'd send you all of this money. But that was kind of the extent of it. And the fraud and kind of all of the bad stuff that has evolved since then has gotten exponentially worse. You also kind of simultaneously have governments, like they missed the boat the first time around. And so now they're really paying attention and they're, some would argue, over-regulating, but at least they're paying attention to a lot of these issues. In the beginning, though, because there was really no government regulation, because nobody was really paying attention, the focus was purely on kind of growth at all costs, right? VCs give a lot of money, they invest in these companies, and they want huge returns, period. The problem is when something bad does happen, particularly if it gets media attention, everybody from the VCs to the executives, all the way down to your customers, are freaking out thinking, how can this happen? And it frankly stains not only the reputation of that business, but the entire industry, the entire ecosystem, right? If you take dating apps, for example, if someone's raped, through somebody they met on a dating app, everybody lumps all dating apps together, regardless of what they're doing with trust and safety, et cetera. And so, in the beginning, there was just simply nothing being done. And when I say nothing, at the core, or I should say at the very end of or spectrum of kind of trust and safety, I think about like digital identity, right? Identifying your users, because if you don't know who your users are, then you can't screen them, you can't do anything to really monitor or prevent them because you don't know who they are. Also, people who aren't using their proper identity are probably there for some nefarious purpose or another, right? Or they're hiding something. And so when I say nothing was happening at the beginning, digital identity, when I went in-house, wasn't a thing. The best they would, the best solutions might confirm or validate emails or phone numbers, but we very quickly realized that that was insufficient and the technology to get around that is just way too easy. And then, of course, you kick somebody off and they just get a new email and then you're kind of in this cycle. And so I think that you had a lot of money being invested in these startups, all focused on growth. A lot of these apps and these platforms became kind of ubiquitous. Everyone was using them. And then when things went bad or horribly wrong, the media paid attention. And then we were all left thinking, like, what is happening? What are they doing? Like, how are they going to prevent this? The reality is you can't prevent all bad things from happening. You can't prevent it in the real world, let alone on the internet, right? And you've added all these anonymous variables on the internet. I've seen kind of in my tenure, it's not so much that bad things happen, it's more how the platforms react when they do happen. There were some really I will call them famous or infamous cases, around the early 2000s with some of the big the rideshare platforms and the homestay platforms where something bad happened. And one Uber had a famous incident where it was an accident, but a driver turning right in San Francisco didn't see this little girl and ran her over, and she died as a result of it. It was horrible. And I think that everybody kind of recognized that it was an accident. There was nothing, no foul play, none of that. But the response was kind of less than adequate, and it didn't really address kind of the nature of or the gravity of what had happened, right? Somebody had lost their life, and the public response was extremely defensive and basically jumped to the fact that they don't have any liability because of the Communications Decency Act, which is a federal law in the US that protects platforms from liability. But it was, tone deaf at best, and frankly didn't, did just horrible disservice to platforms in general, because, when there's been a loss of life, nobody wants to hear about your defenses, right? They need a little compassion. Then Airbnb had one where this woman rented out her really high-end apartment, and I don't remember if they were college kids or who it was, but long story short is they trashed it to the tune of like $50,000 or $60,000 in damage. And the kind of the same tone-deaf response in that we're not responsible, we're simply a passive medium, etc. And this happened over and over, and so I think there was kind of a combination of the how platforms responded, but also the inability to talk about what they were actually doing when it came to trust and safety, because there wasn't a lot happening back in the day, right? And that has evolved greatly. I think you look at any of the certainly the larger platforms, and many of them publish trust and safety reports. They have trust and safety centers, FAQs, et cetera, et cetera. And they're very clear about what they do. And in fact, they are doing a heck of a lot more and spending a lot of money and a lot of resources trying to keep their keep the experience good, but also keep their users safe, more or less.
Yeah, I think those are great examples and shows the magnitude it can have, destroying your reputation or whatever. Maybe also slowing down your growth or network effects and the network creating negative network effects, so that people leaving because they see this and then more people leave. And so you can also have negative network effects, and then it, the people or the users run away from your platform and maybe join a different ones. You also said that platforms learned a lot. So they implemented a lot of mechanisms, starting with identity checks or overseas communication and stuff like that. Now we see maybe the next phase with AI. We see AI is coming up, and with AI you can do a lot of good stuff, but also a lot of more bad stuff. So the bad people are also jumping on this train, and with deep fakes and stuff like that. So how do you see the double-edged sword of AI joining this big picture, maybe from a very high level point of view, and then we can maybe zoom in a little bit more on how can platforms also leverage AI to build and continue to build trust?
I think I'm not the only person who said this, but AI is probably one of the most revolutionary technologies since the internet came out, right? It has the ability to shorten development times, customer service responses, you name it. And there's a valid, very productive use of AI. And I think we're just scratching the surface. We're just learning the capacity, and it's, I think it's, as we learn, it's going to continue to kind of outpace us in any event. The other side of that, though, is online crime fraud, it's organized, And so you think about organized crime as, mafiosos in a New York pizzeria, right, at 3 a.m. That's not the case anymore. Organized crime has gone online, and they have the same tools, if not better, than you and I have access to commit these crimes. To the point that there are AI tools being developed specifically for the purpose of committing fraud, breaking passwords. I mean, you name it, right? You've got a tool that can make any sort of a process exponentially more efficient, right? And so there's a positive side to that, but also the fraudsters, they can use those tools as well to crack passwords faster, to commit whatever crime they're seeking to commit that much faster. And so I think some of the obvious misuses, we'll call them, of AI are like the deep fakes, like the synthetic voices and things like that, where you can quite literally clone someone's voice or their image, to the point that you or I, none of us would probably be able to tell that it wasn't our grandmother or our sister who was leaving us a voicemail or on Zoom with us, which is super scary because it leads people to be extremely vulnerable, and it's almost impossible to detect from, I would say, your everyday user or consumer. Obviously, now we're also developing tools to detect when images are AI generated and when videos are AI generated and sounds and things like that. But I think the high level point here is there are a lot of really good uses for AI, but there are a lot of really bad people who are simultaneously leveraging those tools for nefarious purposes. And they are way ahead of, I think, the good guys, and they are way ahead of the governments, and they are completely outpacing law enforcement. And so we're at a point where we really have to learn quickly, get up to speed quickly to understand, because I don't think we're ever going to stop them. I think the best we'll be able to do is detect it, and prevent people from becoming victims, but I don't think the tools or their sophistication is going anywhere.
So, do you think you mentioned? Sorry, I'm going back a little bit on the previous topic, but it's linked. You mentioned responsibility and of the platforms, and that platforms were initially pushing away responsibility. And I, for one, was always annoyed by that. And that really threw a really bad image on platforms and marketplaces. Fast forward today, do you think platforms are doing enough on this topic of responsibility, taking ownership of risk, of safety, etc.?
So if AI is a double-edged sword, this is like a triple or quadruple-edged sword. So a couple things. One is, I think, just from a customer retention perspective, I'm not even referring to the law or legal liability, but just from a customer retention, acquisition and retention perspective, I think now your users are expecting more from the platforms. And so I think that accepting responsibility, not washing your hands from every incident that happens, not necessarily taking ownership of it, because the reality is these platforms don't have control over what users do between and among themselves. There's certainly stuff that they can do, but at the end of the day, if somebody's going to try and defraud somebody else, the platform likely won't have a lot of control over that. That said, users want to transact in safe environments, and the platforms do have visibility into communications, activity, et cetera. And so I think that the platforms that you and I want to be on are taking more responsibility. They're taking ownership. They're communicating with you more, both about the risks and how to prevent them. They're not pretending that bad things aren't happening. They're being very forward about the fact that, you know, you've got to look out for certain behaviors and protect yourself, et cetera. In some cases, you'll see platforms that will, you know, guarantee transactions up to a certain level to give you some comfort. It's not necessarily, you know, certainly legally, that's not their obligation, but it's a really good way to instill that trust and retain those customers. You know, the question about are they doing enough is so relative. It's so hard to answer because when I think of enough, there are a lot of things that platforms can do that doesn't require even a lot of technology or resources. And I think that, you know, monitoring communications, monitoring activity, you know, especially these platforms that have been around for any amount of time, they have models and they know what normal user behavior is, right? They can map it out, and there's some outliers, but they can also then detect anomalies or abnormal behavior. And there's a certain, you know, each platform is going to have normal use cases for whatever the features and the functionality are. And when you see or you detect abnormal activity, then that's an opportunity to look into that and to try and intercept whatever's happening. And because they have visibility into communications and all of that, there are some really low tech ways to protect your users and potentially prevent. Now, depending on the scale, right, you're going to have a lot of human intervention. And now, obviously, with AI, you've got a lot, you have tools that can also monitor and then raise those issues to a human when it makes sense. So those are kind of the low tech ways, some human intervention, but easy to have a, I would say, like a good vantage point over the whole platform and the whole ecosystem. And again, it's data driven. So this isn't a subjective kind of somebody sitting in a room watching people's online behavior. It's just it's purely, you know, kind of data driven. And then anomalies are surfaced for review. But then you've got a lot of what I would call more expensive tools, right? And so, as I mentioned, you know, digital identity is one of those things that I think is what I always say is the cornerstone of trust and safety. If you don't know your user is who they say they are, you're already on your back foot. Conversely, if you do know who your user is and your user is who they say they are, there's a really good chance that they're probably not going to do anything wrong. People don't use their own identities and commit crimes online, generally speaking. Now, people will do dumb things, don't get me wrong, but they don't set out to commit crimes, and they're probably not in any sort of organized criminal enterprise using their own identification. So the ability to properly identify your users is key, and I think is the kind of the beginning of the solution. A lot of those tools, there's a variety of tools or a variety of signals that you can monitor and confirm and validate, et cetera. And it gets expensive pretty quickly, right? Because you're using, this is all outsourced vendors and solution providers. And even if you're doing this at scale, it's just, it can get expensive. It can also create barriers slow down onboarding, which any technologist is going to tell you is kind of the worst possible thing you can do. So there's kind of this balance. I mean, moving on from there, there's all types of screening solutions, et cetera, that they get expensive, right? So it becomes this balance of how much time do we want to invest? How much money do we want to invest? How many roadblocks? How much friction do we want to add to our onboarding? And then how frequently do we want to do that? And so when the question is asked, are they doing enough? Keep in mind, if they spent all of their money screening and leveraging all of these tools, very likely they would go bankrupt because they're probably not making enough revenue per user to substantiate that. But on the other hand, there are a lot of even low tech ways to curating, but also ensuring that, or doing the best you can to make sure that the ecosystem is healthy and that those bad guys don't get very far, or if they do something that they're gone and you keep them out. So it's why I say, you know, there's we owe a lot to, particularly in the US, the CDA, which protects platforms, we owe a lot to that federal law that says the platform doesn't have any liability for what happens between its users, more or less. And so we've seen a proliferation of platforms and social media and marketplaces because of that. But I can tell you that in the US, most legislators, both sides of the aisle, regulators, they hate it because they think that big tech has gotten away with too much for too long. And I don't disagree with that. I think that there was a lot of irresponsibility that has made that pendulum swing. And so there's not only a lot that can be done, there's certainly more that can be done, but it's kind of a balance, obviously for the depending on the type of platform and kind of what their features and functionalities are.
It's really interesting because there are some layers, maybe more of safety than trust, that indeed you could either implement with technology or regulate with regulation. And then the trust is much more emotional and harder to grasp, and yet maybe that's also very powerful. I mean, you were talking about non or low tech elements that can build trust on a platform. It reminds me of an article I wrote quite a while ago in Forbes on the difference, and as a user and a professional of platforms, I had that look when I was I bought a piece of furniture on one e-commerce site and the furniture arrived with damage, and the platform said, I don't care, it's not my responsibility, versus another one, the same thing happened, and the other one said, look, it's the responsibility of the vendor, however, I'm staying with you and I'm making sure it's going to be sorted. And for me, that made all the difference. And I stopped going on the first one. And so it's a perception. And I guess it doesn't cost them much to have a three-way chat with the vendor and me just chasing the vendor saying, make sure you reply. But it's so powerful in terms of trust.
Yeah, I you see this with Amazon, particularly in the U.S. Their refund policy, almost, and I know it gets abused. So I think that maybe they're a little too generous. But I just from myself, and I study them because I think that they kind of get it in the sense that their 2/3 of their revenue comes from their marketplace, and regardless of the source of the goods that you purchase, whether it's from an Amazon warehouse or from a third party seller, they treat it the same. And as the customer, it's kind of like the customer's always right. They generally obviously issue a credit but it's immediate. And I've never once, and I've never seen it where Amazon kind of washes their hands of the issue. Interestingly, again, in the US, you see when you buy something from a third party seller, very often they will include in the package, if there's any issue with this, contact us directly and we will make it right immediately. I'm sure on the back end, when Amazon has to issue a refund, right, they're not getting paid as well. And so it's in their best interest as well. But they've done a really good job, at least here, of keeping that trust. And as a result, I'm part of the millions of people who, when I'm looking for something, I just go directly to Amazon because I feel like it's going to be protected. It doesn't matter if it's coming from their warehouse or from one of their third party sellers.
Totally. And they set a precedent because then, again, I remember one day I ordered something and I wanted to return it. And the guy said to me, look, I'm not Amazon. So I never bought anything again because right. I didn't have that trust.
Right. Right. And that's the risk, right? I mean, that's the risk, especially when you're doing things, you can't touch it, feel it, right? You can only see it. It's two dimensional. And so there's a much higher trust barrier to buying something. But I don't think twice about buying anything on Amazon, because even if I don't like it, and this is probably the excess point, but even if I don't like it, you can send it back. And you know, the answer, because you often have, or the response, you often have to provide a response to what's wrong, is it didn't work for me. And so as a result, they, I don't know how many thousands of dollars a year I give Amazon, but you know, that's the trust that they've built, and that they continue.
Yeah, also looking a bit into the future and looking ahead. I mean, trust, you described it as something intangible, but it is built over time, right? Slowly over time, and it can leave via a Ferrari or Lamborghini very fast. You build it over time, so a bit of intangible. But on the other side, if you are an owner of a platform or a marketplace, you still ask yourself, it's intangible, but what can I exactly do to build this trust? So we also asked ourselves this question, and we came back with a kind of a concept, which is relying on a concept famously known as the separation of powers. Maybe you know from a state. We also ask ourselves, is there something similar? And when you start thinking, how can I build trust in a state, right? If I'm the USA, if I'm Germany, if I'm France or whatever, then when you look at those modern states, you have this separation of power, and you distinguish between legislative, execution, judicial powers, etc. And so we thought this could be also something like a framework or a concept you can transfer to the whole topic of trust. And when you think about it, and you described it with the two, or Natalie described it with the two cases here, with the two different marketplaces, it first starts with your kind of legislative thing and power, what kind of values you have as a marketplace, right? So you compared Amazon, which has a value like customer first, right? I don't care about the supplier. I more care about the buyers, and I do everything what is in the interest of a buyer and instead of the supplier. And maybe another marketplace is more like balanced or more on the side of the supplier and whatever. So it starts with the top, what kind of values you have, and then it ripples down to the other layers of like what kind of laws I want to implement. Yeah, what is the rule on my marketplace? And then also what kind of trust building mechanisms I want to build. So technical things like an identity check or with the chat or whatever, supervising communication or doing kind of checks on the product itself or whatever else is required. So you can also maybe separate. Long story, this is a kind of a framework we use when we work with clients. Is there anything what you think now with mixing in the AI topic into that? Is there anything what you think is required or marketplace owner can do to build up this trust in the future? So what becomes more and more important in the future?
Yeah, so I think that where there's a huge misstep with AI is part, and where the customer, I think, engages with the platform from a customer service perspective. You know, there's nothing worse than these kind of useless bots that go in circles, right? And you can't get your answer solved. You can't get the problem resolved, because that's the quickest way to ruin any sort of trust that you've built, is to not be accessible for a customer, not to have their problem resolved. And when I talk about a problem, right, it could be something as simple as I have a question about a product, or I got a product, or I interacted with this person and it went horribly wrong, right? And in either case, if I'm not sure how to use this product or how to assemble it, I'm sitting there with the box open and I need an answer. And if I can't get a hold of somebody and I've got this bot and going in a circle, and you know, they're trying to make everything easier and more efficient, and eliminate the number of headcount, I'm frustrated. And so immediately I'm going to think twice about whether or not I shop there. But also, that simple question now kind of escalated into a problem because I've got no response and I'm sitting here and waiting. On the other end of the spectrum, something bad happens, right? The package was broken, or you were shipped something that you weren't, or you were introduced to a caregiver who stole, or blah, blah, blah. Whatever the issue is, whether it's goods or services or any type of platform, if you can't access a human being in your time of need, and whatever that is, it tends to be very critical in the moment, right? Years later, we look back and say, oh, that wasn't that serious. But in that moment, when the thing came broken or you had a horrible experience, that's what you want resolved. And that trust evaporates in that moment if you can't access anyone. So the one thing I fear with AI is the disappearance of humans and the kind of inability to provide really good customer service. Having said this, I'm talking about, I think, outliers. The reality is I think AI can help answer a lot of questions very quickly, and it actually speeds up the response times. And so there's a lot of great aspects to it that I think will probably solve 90 or 95% of the customer service interactions. But it's those ones that don't get resolved, or you're in this like bot doom loop of trying to get some prefabricated response, and you're not getting what you need, and so you just get frustrated, and very quickly it's like I don't want to deal with that anymore. I don't there, as you mentioned, Natalie, there's so many options, and there's so many competitors that if I can talk to, or I know that somebody's going to be on the other end of that line trying to resolve the problem, that's where I'm going to go. So I think that's kind of the low end of the AI kind of risk. I just see it being leveraged, over leveraged, and the customer kind of being not the focus anymore. It's more about the efficiencies internally than anything.
So it's also you need to avoid to lose sight on the basics, right? So this is the basic is response, quickness, and stuff like that. But a lot of people try to implement AI and doing defensive stuff, but then maybe you lose sight of the basics. And but the basics are the basics, and they are responsible for 80-90% of building the trust. So you need to keep them running and working. Another opportunity of AI is also personalization. So we see the biggest opportunity for a marketplace in implementing is not just streamlining operations, but it's also in personalizing the experience for the users on the platform. Could be the buyer side, the seller side, but also the partner side. Are there any points from your point of view how to build trust on the same in the same way that, or in a balance in building up personalization or personal experience?
Yeah, so I think that the personalization is and it's great, right? Because I think what ends up happening is a user doesn't necessarily even realize that they're talking to a machine, right? Because it's that good. I think that monitoring it, right, and really paying attention to the results and the user experience is key, because I think that a lot of these tools are really, really good, but they're not infallible. And there's a real danger with implementing some of these tools and then just letting them go. I mean, we've seen tons of examples of like these AI hallucinations where this, what you think is a personal experience, ends up, there's examples of this tools trying to convince someone to commit suicide, to take these different drugs that were hallucinated and basically gave them a recipe that would have created, I don't remember exactly what but some toxic drug, right? And so unchecked, I think there's you very quickly, especially if you become like the media story about an AI tool gone wrong, I think that that there's the opportunity for it to go south very, very quickly. And it's never going to be perfect, right? So there's always a certain amount of kind of monitoring this and testing it and evolving the tool, particularly in a specific environment where, you know, you're collecting data and you're refining it and the model and all of that.
Yeah, so it's supervising the, not the human, but the AI. Could be also that it makes wrong promises about the product, right? You ask about the product and then it kind of has hallucinating features which are not there. And then it promises you, oh, there is a feature, and then you make a decision and you buy, but and then the product or whatever arrives, then it's not a feature and there's no not this feature. And then so, but you are then responsible because you are the owner of the platform. So
that's right. That's right. That's actually just on that point. One of the big questions, particularly in the US, right, because we have the CDA Section 230, which basically absolves platforms from liability for what happens between their users, right? So you, let's say you're operating this platform, you're leveraging this tool, and one user buys from another, right? And this tool is in the middle and does exactly that, right? Sells a product that is not intended for that use, or something worse happens. You know, the question then becomes, and I think in probably most jurisdictions, the platform has liability. In the US, it's still an open question. I mean, I would argue that there is, because the platform has integrated this tool, and the tool, and they're responsible for the tool. But we have this federal law that says what happens between the users is not the responsibility of the platform. So it's a really interesting question that we're watching play out to see how these tools will impact the legal liability of these platforms.
Yeah, I think very, very good points. Coming maybe to the closure of our podcast, and I think there's a lot of more stuff inside of your book, and we can only recommend all the marketplace owners and platform enthusiasts to have a look at the book, Bulletproof Your Marketplace, right, is the title. Yep. And now available on Amazon and all the other well-known platforms for purchase. And when is the next Marketplace Risk Conference coming up? Is there?
Next week, actually. It's May 12th through 14th in San Francisco. And then September in New York, October in Sao Paulo, and November in London.
Perfect. And maybe looking back at your career and maybe the last years, so we always ask also our guests to share some kind of major learnings or major advice to other leaders. So is there any kind of bigger theme or narrative you would like to share with other leaders, which kind of guided you through the last years, and maybe is also a guiding theme for you for the next years? So
yeah, I mean, with me personally, it's always been kind of, who are you doing this for and why, and staying focused. And I will tell you, we built this entire platform and these conferences specifically for these platform leaders to network and to learn and to collaborate. I mean, that's really our focus. And over the years, there's been a lot of temptation, because there are a lot of within the ecosystem, there are a lot of kind of outside forces that will offer you a lot of money to do a lot of things. And it's tempting, right? Because at the end of the day, like, who doesn't want to make money? But the reality is, we've stayed very focused on who our target is and why we're doing this. So I always tell people, I always tell our team, you know, whenever you think about any sort of an addition to a conference, any new location, any sort of whatever it has to do with the app, whatever it has to do with the events, you've got to think about our target. How is it going to benefit them? Is it something that they're going to benefit from? And if not, we need to evaluate that, because that's why we're here and that's what we do. I guess the overarching theme would be kind of that discipline, but really, really staying disciplined. And I say that from my perspective, but even with clients and when I consult, one of my first questions is like, who's your target here? Who are you going after? Because what I see a lot of times is trying to go after too many at the same time, and it just doesn't work. And so that discipline, I think, is really useful, especially in the early days when it's really easy to get distracted and kind of lose your eye off the ball.
So it's know your customer and know your target group and then focus, focus, focus. That's, I think, right. very good advice. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for joining and sharing your thoughts and your insights on this whole topic. Absolutely. I mean, we scratched the surface and there's a lot of more stuff to digest. So we recommend buying the book reading through it or joining you on your conferences and going into exchange with other platform leaders. So thank you very much from my side for joining.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. It was great. My favorite topic.
Or linking with Natalie. We will also put links to the book and conferences in the show notes for everybody who wants to. Learn more and click on the links in the show notes.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.